Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the few Black-owned radio stations. And you're live with the best mind in Black America, me, Sean Williams, and this is The Cutting Edge Show. Justin Jackson is co-hosting with me. This evening, I have a special guest, Alonzo Waheed Sr. Last year, he was my first guest that I had on my show. He is the lead organizer for Equity and Transformation, a 2020 fellow with the Electoral Justice League. He is also the founder of Gatekeepers, a male mentoring initiative. Alonzo, welcome back to my show. How are you doing? And what was last year like?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you all for having me back. It's truly exciting to be back. We had a wonderful year last year, a year that I wasn't expecting. We had hit some major milestones, and just want to be able to come out today and share the work that I've been doing and how we hope that the work that I have been doing and the goals that we have accomplished that is able to affect everyone in a positive way.
Well, that is great. So tell us all about it.
All right. Starting off, right off back, it was a couple of milestones that we hit that we were not even expecting to actually make. And a lot of it was due to part of it was due to COVID. But then another part of it was just due to individuals being fed up, especially Black organizers, grassroots organizations, had just decided that enough was enough and it was time for a change. So with that, one of the things that was major that had came out was during COVID, we found out that, you know, the work that I do with Equity and Transformation, working with the informal community, individuals always asking, well, what is the informal community? And just the bottom line to it is individuals that have been forced out of the formal economy. For a long time, we as a people, you know, going all the way back to the days of chattel slavery, it was, you know, and that's going all the way to the extreme, but it's true and it's what was real for us as a people. We was forced out of the economy while we're forced out of the formal economy while others were able to be able to profit from the work that we've done. But we was always the ones who was working hard at labor. And more importantly than that, we had to find ways for us to survive when the formal economy or, you know, capitalism in itself seemed like it was not designed for us. The design for us was for us to constantly be on the bottom of that. So we had to find ways around that just to survive. So in that in itself, right, is what the formal economy is. And the simplest way to say it is it's the ones who's out here hustling, the ones who out here trying to figure out a way to survive where they're not being taxed, whether it's singing on a subway, which we have a lot in Chicago, or beating on buckets, braiding somebody's hair, doing babysitting on the side, or even having to stand outside and sell a pack. It's like even when you go into these streams of just having to sell your body even, right? Because it's not like individuals are choosing to go into this. Most of the time, we're forced into the informal economy because the formal economy has pushed us out.
Okay.
And I have a question for you. Do you feel like the formal economy has evolved from what it was? And do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think that most definitely I think that it has evolved. And why I think that it's a good thing is because, like, right off back, you have to remember that. So let's get into the facts of it, right? Because a lot of times people try to misconstrue what's going on. Laws were created, right, to criminalize an individual because they figured out a way how not to be a part of the system after the system has forced them out. So what do I mean by that? We had bootlegging, right? And all while bootlegging was illegal, we had individuals that was able to make a livelihood because this was now not taxed. But the minute that it became taxed, black workers were forced out of this. But then we find out years later that Jack Daniels got his recipe from a black man, right? Stole his recipe from a black man. We have the lottery, which is like right now people are going playing the lotto. It's like $500 million here. You know, I can win $900 million, right? But and that is widespread. Like all over the country you have the lotto. But then when it was the numbers game, black individuals had industry, and we was able to survive with that. This is how we was able to feed our families, but then it was criminalized. We see the same thing with the marijuana industry right now, right? When it was blacks, it was demonized, right? But this is how individuals was taking care of themselves, because when you flip that and you ask, well, what industry do we have? We don't have the police, all right? They gave that to the Polish, all right? You don't have the fire department. We don't have the hair industry. We don't have, like, if all our stores are owned by Arabs or someone else, like, we don't have any industry within our communities. Even when you start looking at the unions, like, how many, when you look at the numbers of African Americans or minorities that's part of the unions, right? The numbers are under 10%. But these are the livelihoods. And then when you go back and you look at the history, how they took the skills, all right? When I say skills, when they took the skilled laborers, they took that up out of the communities. They took that up out of schools, right? Because these were jobs that we could have, whereas we didn't have to go to school and receive a degree, right? I could work with my hands, all right, and be able to get benefits through my job, be able to own me a home, be able to take care of myself and take care of my family. But they stripped all of that away. And one of the most important things that people fail to realize this, and this is as a country, right, why it was so hard to form a union around agriculture is because blacks was the largest people that was in control of agriculture at that time, but we was doing all of that work for free as slavery, as slaves. So they never wanted to organize us, and they never wanted us to become part of a union. And this is why the work that I do is so important.
Okay, what about some of the legislation that we were discussing before this, that you want to elaborate on that and tell us about that?
Yeah, so just looking at a lot of the things that has been going on, some of the legislation that was recently passed was the cannabis equity bill out of Illinois, which is the major bill right now, whereas individuals had, so inside the bill, the language in there is that they had to recognize that individuals were victimized by the war on drugs and that there were communities that were targeted by the war on drugs. So in the bill, that was acknowledged, and also inside the bill, it said that those harms had to be repaired. So that was very major. One of the most major things that we accomplished in last year. But outside of that, we also have a guaranteed income pilot program. All right, and that guaranteed income pilot program aims to provide an innovative solution to economic inequality and also to help to reduce recidivism. And what this does is provide a guaranteed income for individuals that was previously incarcerated in West Garfield Park area. And we understand that a guaranteed income will help reduce income volatility, it'll lessen psychological stress, it improves physical functioning, and ultimately it will help to reduce recidivism. And with that, right, this is how the crime rate not only goes down, but it helps to start restoring an individual, because 9 times out of 10, when individuals are committing these petty crimes, or then sometimes resorting to violence, is because they're at the end of their rope and they no longer have any hope. So with that guaranteed income pilot, we believe that that's going to help out a lot. But one of the things that stem, when we also look at legislation that was passed, we have the Illinois Breathe Act, which is actually sitting on the governor's desk right now, waiting for him to sign it. And this was a direct response from the riots and everything that occurred over the summer that we had to deal with the murder of George Floyd. So with this act, right, it deals with police reform, where now we're able to make sure that the police are having body cams. We're able to make sure that they have a real review board and is by citizens. We're able to make sure that they're going to demilitarize the police. So now they're not coming into our communities anymore and treating us like not only second-class citizens, but like it's treating our communities like they're war zones, right? So it's a lot inside of the Breathe Act. It was an omnibus bill, and we helped to get that passed with a lot of hard work that went on, not only behind the scenes, but actually getting out, organizing, galvanizing the community. And like I said in the beginning of the program, it was because we've gotten to the point whereas enough is enough.
I totally agree.
One of the other things that I didn't mention was how one of the campaigns that we had throughout the summer was the COVID mutual aid campaign. In that initiative, it aimed to support Black informal workers by establishing community care networks and providing direct financial assistance to individuals that was excluded from receiving relief through the CARE Act. What individuals didn't realize is that where everybody was getting stimulus checks, right, and this is bringing me back full circle, while most individuals was getting stimulus checks, it was individuals that never filed taxes. They didn't have no way to send you a stimulus check, so you was just out there, right, because this is how they knew who to send the stimulus checks to. So if you never, so if you wasn't working, you didn't have a 9-to-5, whereas you had to file taxes, how were you able to get a stimulus check? And then also, it also had hit individuals that may not have been working, may have having their taxes taken out and then sent to child support. These individuals were not able to receive this. Now, this was at a time where the Black communities were hit hardest, right? And it's always that the ones at the bottom are getting hit the hardest. So this was like a double slap in your face. Even though you don't have anything and even though your community is getting hit harder, what we was going to give to you, we're not going to give to you, all right? So we had, again, created the initiative of the mutual aid campaign, and that made sure that individuals that was excluded were able to receive funds so that they could survive also.
We have two callers that may have questions. The first one is 8051. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I do. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Okay. Lonnie, first of all, I would like to commend you for all the things that you're doing for the Black brothers and sisters. And
thank you.
I haven't heard anything thus far that I would like to say that would be negative of what you are doing. My question is, how can other people join in their area and do the same thing that you are doing for the people in their neighborhoods? Because I live in Southern Illinois, and I haven't heard of any program or anybody doing what you are doing, because where I live, you know, the Blacks who are already well off, they aren't really doing that much for the people that need it. They're only doing things to make themselves look good. And it's a lot of people down here, younger people, who could benefit from the actions that you are taking in your area.
I want to first start off by saying I sincerely and humbly thank you for your comment, and because it's not every day that you hear individuals thanking me or organizers like me for the work that I'm doing. Is usually always a fight or individuals that's very argumentative, and they would try to break down everything that we have accomplished or that we are doing. So again, I sincerely want to thank you. And my direct answer to your question is, we see and have seen over the last year the individuals echoing. We've heard individuals echoing your very same sentiments. And what we have decided to do, and I was not going to actually say this on tonight's interview. We were saving it for the it was going to be a summer campaign that we was going to release it in May. But what we are planning on doing in direct relation to everything that we have heard and everything that we have seen is that we're going to do a tour. And we're going to start in Rockford. We're going to hit Kankakee. And we're going to go straight from Kankakee all the way down to Marion. And we're landing at SIU. And the reason why we're doing that is that this is in direct relation to where individuals decided to build penitentiaries and take individuals up out of Chicago through prison gerrymandering and house them downstate so that they would be able to count them in a census and then be able to receive money from them without actually representing them. Again, using them as slave labor and then having these individuals being able to come in and work for Fortune 500 companies, but then once released, they can't even get a job at a regular 9-to-5. So we're very serious about this, and what we're going to do doing throughout this tour is we're going to be establishing chapters along the way. So just know that we're coming there soon, and we will be there, and we will be setting up a chapter in Carbondale.
Well,
okay, thank you.
I appreciate that.
Okay, we have another caller, 5509.
Caller, you had a question?
What was the
5509, you live? I don't have a question. I'm just listening in.
Oh, okay.
And again, one of the other highlights that we've had last year was Tuesday, April 7th. We had went out with a coalition of organizations from across Chicago, and we had, because of COVID, we was not able to put our action together where we would all be able to gather together. But so what we did was had a roving noise demo. And that was just a matter of us having all of our cars lined up, and we went to 26th in California, demanding that our elected officials, including Governor Pritzker, Cook County Chief Judge Timothy Evans, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, and Cook County State's Attorney Kimberly Fox, support the mass release of incarcerated people in the state of Illinois. And we did that so that it would prevent the further spread of COVID-19. And as a result, We had individuals that was able to be released from Cook County Jail, and there was over 4,000 individuals that was able to be released because of that action. And why these things are important is because people have a misconception that because you go to jail that you're automatically a criminal, that you're automatically guilty, right? When you're sitting there at 26 in California, 9 times out of 10, you haven't being found guilty, and we have individuals that were sitting there not found guilty that was now being almost faced with a death sentence because individuals were truly dying from COVID-19, and COVID-19 was being widespread in the Cook County facility at that time. So it's like they was basically sitting there waiting to catch COVID. So we demanded that those individuals were able to be released. And then what another part to that is individuals act as though you're criminalized just because you're poor, right? You don't get the same rights as other individuals who have more money just because they have more money. Not that they're right and that you're wrong. It's just that they have more money. So they can go and they can commit a crime and get out the jail the same day because they can bond out. But because you have a bond that you can't pay that's under $1,000 now, which means that you don't have $300, you don't have $500. It means that you sit in jail and you have to wait for months before you even go to court, months before your trial. And what happens 9 times out of 10 is that individuals will choose to cop out. Some individuals will say, well, I'd rather take this ride because it's down at the penitentiary. It's better there than it is here for me. So we have a lot of individuals. When I say a lot, we have over 70% of individuals copping out for plea deals that they never would have copped out for because they don't want to stay in jail and deal with those situations and deal with those conditions when all the time the only reason at the end is because they could not bond out. So one of the things that we also have just recently passed, which is HB 6353, which is the Fairness Act. What happens with that bill is that it helps to eliminate cash bonds. So by the year 2023, there will be no more cash bond in the state of Illinois.
Now, what year is that going to take place?
So we're waiting for the governor to sign a bill, but everything should be enforced by the year 2023. But some elements of that bill will already be in place, and I can always come back or I can share the information with you where certain dates, some parts of the bill will already be enforced, such as individuals that lost their licensing because of being locked up in jail and couldn't bond out, they will be able to get their licenses back.
Okay, that's great thing right there. We have another caller, 6085. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, my name is Yvonne Wahi.
How are you doing, Yvonne? Yeah, we can hear you.
Thanks. Okay. I had a question about your company or your place of business going to other places. What about going out of the city of Illinois? I grew up in Chicago, so I know exactly what you're talking about going there, being there, and what's going on there. And I'm grateful to you for doing what you're doing. But I live in Florida now. And I want to know what could be done down here like what's being done up there, because we have problems down here just like y'all have up there, and there's nothing being done. And I don't know which way to turn right, come home, to go, to stay here or nothing, because everything, like I'm living my life the same thing over again. I'm going through the same thing, but not the exact same thing, but it's just hard down here now. And I come back home, it's just a struggle either way I go. So my question is, what could be done down here in Florida?
All right, what part of Florida are you in?
Tallahassee.
All right. So I'm also part of the Electoral Justice League, and that's a national organization. And the work that I do with them, we also have individuals down there in Florida, but they're in Orlando and they're also in Miami. But, again, we also, with Equity and Transformation, we are not only national, like we have chapters all the way in Benin, Africa. So if you all are having issues there that need to be dealt with, it's nothing like organizing a community. The thing is, one of the things that we've ran into a lot, right, is that when how hard it is to help individuals who say that they want help, but then when you give them the help is rejected. So one of the models that we use is that we don't go into communities saying that we're here to help you. We go into the community becoming a part of the community, and these are just resources that we have. So we're not telling anybody that this is the way to solve your problem, this is what you should do, this is how you should do it. We come in saying we're a part of the community just like you. So if any individuals are taking advantage of you or we see these injustices, we're seeing those injustices happen to us, and this is the way that we're going to respond. The most important part, though, is are individuals really tired of being tired and willing to go forward and make a change? Because I could bet that you're not the only one feeling that way, but it's nothing like just being able to organize the people and saying that if we all are tired of this, right, then now we must take the next step to not only organize but educate, inform, empower, and then from that changes are made. Because whatever it is you're dealing with, whatever that issue is, if you're not the only one that's dealing with that issue, what is it going to take to change that? And if there's like-minded individuals like you who's willing to make that change, it's just about going forward and doing the work. And we're here to help. So all you have to do is reach out to me. I can definitely give you all my information, but this is why we're here to – this is the work that we do.
So what would it take for you to, like, for you or for your organization to, you know, actually start a chapter somewhere? Like, what is the actual process that, you know, that needs to be done?
All right. So our process is first, we have four pillars that we have to, that's part of our organization. Just this is how we are. So with that, we have the first part is the research part, which we come in and we do the research. We find out what is the problem. And then from that, we ask the community, what do they think will solve the problem? And the reason why we do this is a lot of times we have individuals coming from the outside thinking that they could solve our problems. Like, if you're not in our house, how do you know what's going to solve the problems in our house? So this is why we become a part of that household. But even with becoming a part of the household, we still ask the individuals that have been there the longest, how do they think the problem should be solved? And we think that they should be directly involved with helping to solve that problem. So that's the research part. After the research part, that's when we go in and we start doing the organizing, all right? We find other like-minded individuals that wants to be involved that saying, hey, listen, I feel the same way. What do we need to do? So then from that point, once we start getting individuals organized, and we do this through informationals, through teach-ins, all right, and this is just galvanizing a community, right? And then once we have the community galvanized, we move from there to policy. Now we start writing policy to help to change. And then when we say policy, right, it's not just on a legislative level where we're going back and forth with our legislative body, but it's also community policy. So it's like in Chicago, it's a policy, no snitching, right? But what does that mean? If somebody was to come and rape your daughter, right? What do you mean no snitching, right?
Right.
So we had to talk to the stakeholders in the community to say, what is the policy going to be if a harm was committed, right? So through talking to the stakeholders in the community, all right, we develop policy that say, okay, listen, if a harm was created, all right, this is how we remedy those harms. So this is what we go forward doing with the policy aspect. And then after that, the fourth part of it is after the research, after the organization, after we deal with policy, we also make sure that individuals know about the work that we're doing, right? And then we put this out through our podcast, through our newsletters, all right, through our social media networks, because that what often happens is when people don't understand or don't know what you're doing, it often falls to the wayside, or individuals believe that there's nothing being done. And what also happens is that you could have done some great work that nobody is taking advantage of. And that's why I wanted to come on today when I was like, wow, okay, I definitely wanted to speak about the survival economies part. I definitely wanted to speak about the legislation that was passed with the BREATHE Act, because this helps to change lives of individuals, not just for today, but for tomorrow and so on. Like this has made history. So we want to make sure that individuals get that information so then they will be able to benefit from it. It's nothing like having a golden ticket in your back pocket and not knowing that it's there.
Have another caller, 0703.
I believe they hung up.
Okay. Justin, do you have a question for Alonzo?
Yes. No, I mean, just going about, you know, a little bit about what he was saying and like the work that they are doing. I think, you know, one, that is phenomenal work, and we do have to make sure that people are able to utilize that. So I know you said you can give out your information. I guess what's the best way for people to reach out and to, like, you know, get this process started? Do you guys have, like, social media that you can, you know, give out to the people?
Yeah, you can go to www.eatchicago.org. That's our website. And you can find all of the information there.
Okay. And what does that website look like? Just so if it's someone's first time, they want to make sure that, you know, they're in the right spot.
Okay. Let me see. Let me go in real quick and see if I can pull it up. You'll see a black and white EAT logo that says EAT.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then you will be able to see individuals with orange shirts on, their fists in the air, individuals with black jackets on, because the website is able to shift back and forth. It's like a slideshow.
I think that's, you know, I think that's very good information, just so, you know, when people get on there, they know what they're looking for. Now, when they get onto the website, let's say, like, the last caller from Tallahassee, you know, she wants to, she already feels galvanized. She's already feels motivated. You know, what is her next step? What is the next step for her to do? She goes to the website, you know, what does she click on?
So she can go to the get involved part. So at the top, it says equity and transformation, EAT, and black and white. Up under it, you'll see home, about us, campaigns and programs, research and outreach. And then it'll say get involved, right? She will hit the get involved button. Once she gets to that tab, she's able to go in and scroll down, and then she'll find out about our membership meetings, and she'll find out about the newsletters, how to contact us. Let us know what's going on, and this way she can take action, right? And the only thing that she has to do is just become a member. That's really just the bottom line to it. Once you become a member, now you have access to our resources. You have access to us. And from that, we start getting the job done.
Awesome.
Okay.
No, I think that's phenomenal. So now, I mean, now we know where we got to go. You know, we know what we got to do, and, you know, get and that's realistically, in my opinion, you know, a huge call to action. These members that once you become a member, I guess, like, is there a process fee, signing fee, or, and, like, what is all that it take, you know, to be a member? Like, like when you first became a member, what was that experience like for yourself?
So it was different with me when I became a member. Because I came in on the ground running, came in organizing. I had came in from another organization that I was working with. I was part of an initiative whereas I was working with individuals that was most likely to commit gun violence or was a victim of gun violence. and it's called the READY program out of Chicago. So what that READY program did was it helped to provide an income for these individuals while they received cognitive behavior therapy training, and then it also gave them a job. So I was their coach. So for about 2 hours in the morning, they would spend that time with me going through their cognitive behavior therapy, and then for the rest of the day, they would go out and work, get paid $15 an hour doing work in the community, and this was able to keep them from being out there shooting at someone or someone shooting at them, right? So then Equity and Transformation found out about the work that I was doing there because all of these individuals that I was working with, what the connection was they was all from the informal community. So it was like before they get to that point, right, where individuals are shooting at them or they're having to shoot at someone, what can we start doing to catch them before that? And why are they part of this informal economy, right? Because what happened often is people talk about the why, but they don't talk about the what. And the what is what happened to create the situation in the first place, right? So that right there was the what, and this is how I became involved with the work with Equity and Transformation. Richard Wallace had found out about me and said, hey, listen, I need to get Alonzo in here. And I had hit the ground running with him, getting out, starting to organize. I've always been an organizer, whether it was out in the community, figuring out that, hey, we're not going to stand for this any longer. We need to eat ourselves. And I had to figure out a way not only for myself but for my brother and my sisters, being able to organize that way or getting out doing professional grassroots organizing, saying, hey, our communities need to be better than this, and we can stand up and make it better. Because regardless of what anybody may think, the truth is nobody is going to be coming to save us, all right? We have to start putting our hands to the plow, doing the work for ourselves. And it's not saying that, okay, we don't believe in God or we don't believe in higher power. What I believe is that God has given us a mindset and a desire to say that it is better than this, all right? And we don't have to depend on somebody else. We've shown too many times in too many different ways that we can figure this out. One of the biggest arguments that I'm going back and forth with about now is that, and this is not any type of way to distract from where we're at, but what I'm seeing often is that we as a people have the ability to persevere, all right? We've shown that. We have the ability to survive. We've shown that. We've shown that we have the ability to produce. We've shown that. What happens, though, often is that when we do all of those things, it's often taken from us. And we're often victimized, or we can only do it as long as we're making someone else a profit. And I think that the time for that is long gone, and we have to be able to stand up as a person, as a community, as an entity, and say, hey, listen, we can do this, all right? And it's not just we could do it for you, but we can do it for ourselves.
Right. Do you guys? I know you say whenever you go into a community, you know, you ask the people what do they think they need. I know a lot on our show, you know, we talk about, you know, different things that, you know, the Black community need, and a lot of that, you know, is more Black businesses. Are you guys able to help with, you know, getting a Black business started in a certain sector, or do you guys do anything like that?
So the way I answer that is let's go back a moment and just listen to what you said. You said that there's not a lot of Black businesses, right?
No, I said that in some communities there are not a lot of Black businesses. So do you guys
right? In some communities there's not a lot of Black businesses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I say the exact opposite. I say, in most of our communities, our Black communities, there are a lot of Black businesses. Every one of those individuals out there that's having to hustle on the streets, braid hair, pump somebody's gas, go babysit, doing a bootleg Uber, right? Whatever it is they're doing that's off the books, that's their business. And this is the way that they've been surviving, right? So these are all of their businesses, is that we have the mindset that it's illegitimate or that something is wrong with it, where the truth is all of these businesses were natural and all of these businesses was here first, and it was individuals came in and figured out a way to tax us for that and then said this was a way to have a legitimate business. So what we do is show the differences between those two, because we also show this. All we have 80% of the individuals in a certain community that don't have jobs, but they have to figure out a way to survive. Now, here's the ironic part. They would say that these individuals are criminals, right? So we'll take, for example, individuals over in West Garfield, the west side of Chicago. These individuals, roughly 75 to 80% African-American males between the ages of 18 and 25, they're unemployed, right? So they're out here trying to figure out a way to survive. And with them figuring out a way to survive, they may be just doing just that, out here selling some weed on a block, selling some loose cigarettes, selling some socks, selling some candy, whatever, right? These individuals are criminalized. But the money that they make, they're taking to pay for Pampers, which that's through Procter & Gamble. They're paying their cell phone bill, which is through AT&T, Verizon, or whoever, right? They are going buying clothes 9 times out of 10 from some type of Walmart, JCPenney, or Target, right? So they're taking their money from the informal economy because they were pushed out of the formal economy, and then they're having to put their money back into the formal economy, which pushed them out. And I think that that is something that we do not acknowledge. Individuals don't pay attention to it. They say that we're not good enough to work for them, but they do not question when we bringing them the money back. And that's a big problem.
Right. No, I mean, I think that is a huge issue. I guess, like, I mean, obviously we can get, you know, vote to try to get legislation passed to, you know, change that, right? But, like, you know, I feel like, you know, in some cases, like, I mean, I hear that. I just want to do more than survive. I want to see people more than survive, you know. And it's like I want to see people live and thrive, you know. And granted, you know, getting legislation has changed to help to not make that illegal, you know, is one thing. But, like, I know, like, earlier in this conversation, you was even talking about how, like, the marijuana laws and how they had to take responsibility pretty much, you know. But, like, at the end of the day, it's like also, you know, it's like, you know, we need tangible things that's going to actually, you know, go – that's going to go with that, not just a, I'm sorry, you know, because now they're having licenses, you know, for you to be able to grow and produce, you know, and you got to put down $1 million. You know, you got to actually have, you know, real capital, you know, to do such things. And it really shines not just one sector. I mean, just the people who have the money who can do it. But it's just crazy that they didn't lock up generations of people, you know, for a certain act. And now they're going to legalize that act, but they're going to put the barrier of entry so high that the same people who was profiting from people being locked up are now going to profit from that law being changed. You know, and I think, like, you know, things like that, we got to make sure that, you know, we vote. We got to make sure we run for office. We got to make sure that, you know, we in the community are aware. I think that's what's really important. And I don't know if you listened in, you know, a couple of months back, especially during the campaign, you know, we talk extensively on, you know, like politics and procedures and things that, you know, we want to see. And honestly, just what was that? Was it not last week, but the week before last? We, you know, we had the question, you know, what does Joe Biden have to do to earn, you know, your vote? I guess, you know, right now in the situation, and I still think that's a great, you know, great question, especially with the work that you're doing. I don't know what your policy politics is. You know, I feel like I have a good perspective on it. But, like, you know, as far as the current administration, what do the current administration or what do you feel the current administration needs to do to, one, boost and help you to thrive, to continue to do the work that you're doing to be as most effectively and just for the black community in general?
All right. So for me to answer that, I want to give a little bit more background on what happened over this summer. With my work with equity and transformation, it was a couple of other things that we were able to do. So throughout the summer, some of the highlights were, and I'm going into this to answer your question. Some of the highlights was during the time of the George Floyd murder, there was a protest all over the country. And we had some protests in Chicago. We had protests in Joliet. And one of the things that had happened was President Trump had came out and he had said that while all these protests was going on, that the mayor should, that the mayors are responsible and that they should take back their cities. And we had the mayor of Joliet go out and assault Victor Williams and Jamal Smith. He actually choked them, threw them down to the ground, and then the police had beat them, all right? So this was the mayor going out and assaulting somebody, and then the police jumped on this person, right? So with our accountability campaign, it led to the charges being dropped against Victor Williams and Jamal Smith. But what also happened was during this time, we also had campaigns that was going on throughout the whole country. And this is my work with the Electoral Justice League and with Equity and Transformation, where we had the Freedom Fall Fellows. And then throughout that fellowship, all right, the goal of that campaign was to make sure that Illinois was to be in formation with nearly 350 leaders and activists in 17 cities across the U.S. And this would illustrate how to divest from policing and reimagine public safety. The other thing that the Freedom Summer Fellows had also did was we had trained and developed 10 Freedom Fellows, Freedom Summer Fellows, and they worked with us to build police accountability in the city of Joliet and support local mutual aid and defund efforts. All right, and why these things are important is because people often forget that it's through grassroots organizing that this is how, especially in black communities, right? And I say especially because as time goes on, people tend to forget that Biden was losing, right? Mm-hmm. And through him losing, they had to start calling on, and they saw the value in the black community. So then it came from black organizers organizing in these communities, and this is why I bring up what happened, right? So then through the black organizing, all right, and I had got a lot of pushback from my counterparts and from my allies saying, hey, how could you all be supporting everybody, getting individuals out to the polls, doing all of this big, massive push for the Democratic Party when the Democratic Party hasn't been too favorable to you all, right? And that's the word that I use right now. They have not been too favorable to you all. But we said that we needed to make sure that we got Trump out of office because it wasn't Trump. It was his ideology. It was the individuals that was coming behind him, supporting him, which later on you see the Proud Boys and all these white supremacists, because this is where it starts getting real.
I mean, I think it was Trump too, though. I mean, I think you got to get blame with blame too.
From my standpoint, I think that he was pushing a lot of buttons and he had got some power that he didn't really believe that he was going to get, and he loved it so much because behind the scenes, right, we're seeing what's really going on behind the scenes, and this is how I go to answer your question. If they were really serious about changing, making major change, you could see the direct contrast when they was looking at Black Lives Matter coming to the Capitol. versus when Trump is saying, okay, he wants the Trumpsters to be there. Where were all of the individuals in military? Where was the military presence at? But then not only that, right, how was individuals able to storm the Capitol like that, go up in there and do everything that they did? Like, lives were lost, right? But then even after that, we still have over 150 legislators that's coming in still supporting this ideology that, you know what, the vote was stolen, right? So this is why I point to the ideology. This is why I'm using this language. It says, now Trump is done. He's gone, right? He's no longer the president now. They're still arguing about whether or not he was right or wrong, or whether or not he should not even be tried or held accountable for his acts, right? So this goes back to the white supremacist mind state, whereas, you know what, I could do whatever I feel like doing, and then I'm still right, right? Regardless of what harm I cause, because I should never be held accountable for that because I was just going through something. Whereas an individual of color or a minority is treated less than that and treated by a different standard, right? Because if it was Obama who would have stood up and said that, and if it was blacks that would have stormed that, they would not ever had the chance, and they showed that. Because when you look at the pictures and you see the contrast of what actually happened, they had a heavy military presence there when they thought that Black Lives Matter was coming. When they knew that these individuals were going to arrive, nobody was there. All right, so this is where we're at. So when I think about what Biden needs to do, individuals need to be held accountable for those treasonous acts. He's in a position of authority to make sure that that happens. And for him to sit back and not do that, or to go back and forth as to try to negotiate with them to have some type of normalcy, I'm very afraid of what that normalcy is, because it means that we're just at the bottom and that they should be treated one way while we're treated a worse way. And then also, before any type of healing could be done, I think that Biden should be the first one to give an example of what healing looks like, and he should repair the harm that was created with the 94 crime bill when they locked up hundreds of thousands of African Americans, males, and took them from their homes and from their communities and locked them up in penitentiaries and able to benefit from that, because he was co-authored with that 94 crime bill, and he's responsible for that. So since he did that, he should be an example of how to repair the harms that was committed. And that's my stance on how we should respond to that.
I mean, I think that's a very notable, you know, position. I know one of the things that just came out, you know, today, well, it's not that it just came out today, but one of the things they was really talking about was like the stimulus. What do you, and I know like part of the work that you said that you guys was research that you guys went into, you know, people who hasn't been filing taxes, you know, not being able to get a stimulus check. What do you think they can do, you know, as far as like the stimulus package that, you know, would really, what do you think, not what they could do, but what they should do?
Well, that's what we point back to, our guaranteed income. First of all, I'll say this. Way before COVID, we've been dealing with these issues. And our issues are lack of resources. Our issues are poverty. Our issues are low or no health care. All right? So with the and then also with our schooling, with our educational system, all of these things, we've been at the bottom of the barrel. And it's time for the government to acknowledge what they did to us as a people, all right, and to come in and to repair their harm, not only in the form of conversation or words, saying I'm sorry. They've yet to even do that or even acknowledge that they were in the wrong. But they need to acknowledge that, and they need to repair that harm. And I think that it needs to be repaired through the form of reparations. So this was the push that we was saying before, and it has happened with COVID. And the first thing that they said was, well, how do we know who the money should go to? Or where should the money go? Or it wasn't enough money, right, for them to do that. And then COVID hit, and they showed that it was enough money, because they was able to give everybody in the country well, mostly everybody in the country, a $600 check, right? So it's not like this cannot be done. It's just that they don't want to do it. And this is why we have the tragedy that we have, because the harm has not been repaired. It's very, it's an awful thing for two individuals to be living in the same house, and one individual has abused, neglected, and deprived one individual, and then expect that person to be able to say, "Well, you live in the same house as me. You have the same benefits as me, and you're equal to me." No, I'm not. Especially when you won't even let me be who I am, right? You're not even giving me that opportunity. That every time that I rise up any, all right, your foot becomes heavier on my neck. We saw and we understand what it means when we talk about Black Wall Street. We saw what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We see what happened in Bronzeville. We see what happened on the west side of Chicago with the Black Panthers. So we see what happened to all of our black leaders, right? Most of them were assassinated or they was castrated. So we saw all of these things, right? And it's time for us to say again, we're not waiting for them to give it to us. We have to start figuring it out ourselves. Figuring it out for ourselves, making sure that we can keep it.
Most definitely. I think that always starts, you know, at home. We got to make sure we're doing our part. Rashawn, do you have any more questions?
Yes, I want to know more about your male mentoring.
So the male mentoring initiatives is with Gatekeepers, and I guess that's a perfect segue from when we were talking about what starts off in a home. We believe that that right off bat, that males should, especially black males, this is all males, period, but we believe that black males are at a deficit right now, and that they, for them to do, and it's a direct reflection of the way our communities are. So for our communities to survive, our men need to be back in their positions as men, and to be able to not only take care of themselves, but take care of their families. As we look at the research, we see that black males are at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to economics, when it comes to skills, and also when it comes to education and when it comes to health, right? So we looked at those four categories, and we wanted to make sure that they were addressed, and that through that, a man becomes his own gatekeeper, where he could dictate what's going to come in and outside of his gates, whether it's his ear gates, his eye gates, his mouth gates, because if he can dictate what's going to come in and out of him, right, he can now be the example of what a positive role model should be. He'll be able to take care of himself better. He's showing that he can take care of himself better, and then he'll be able to take care of his family better, which in turn will make the community better, which will in turn make us better as a people. So we work with individuals from the age of 16 on up, and what we do is we go through these eight gates, four of which I just mentioned, but then also we added the part with spirituality. We believe that every man needs to understand that he's a spiritual being. However he wishes to practice that, that's on him. But he did not create himself, and he needs to first understand that. And it also points later on to that is bigger than you. And then from that, we look at the educational aspect, also the community development part, saying after you've gathered all of these skills, you're not successful until you could now make others successful. So it's now taking all of that back to your community. So it starts with a male taking care of himself, and then being able to take care of his home, and from that, being able to take care of his community.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we talked about that heavily, you know, especially on here. Have you ever heard of a man by the name of Willie Lynch?
Yeah. Yeah, I've read the Willie Lynch letter and talked about it plenty of times.
Yeah, I mean, like, I just think, you know, we're reversing a lot of that will, you know, I mean, really, I think, you know, that's really gets the engine going, how I personally feel. Michonne, did you have other questions?
Yeah, I do. I know you had talked about your lead organizing work, but what else are you doing that we should know about?
Well, we're currently working on another initiative for individuals that, and then it's going to be particularly for individuals downstate. What we're looking at doing is building a coalition of individuals that was previously incarcerated. So to do that, we wanted to make sure that everybody was being represented. So in doing that, if you look at just Chicago, right, in itself, mm-hmm. well, just Illinois, right? So in Illinois, there are over 4.2 million working adults, right, working age adults. So just to put things in context, right, you have 4.2 million working age adults in Illinois, but these individuals have convictions. Right, they have conviction records. So individuals could truly understand this. The population of Illinois is 12.7 million people. So this amount is approximately 42% of the state's working age adult population. So what we're looking at is that in the city of Chicago and throughout the state of Illinois, individuals who are arrested. They are disproportionately punished. So what it points to is that individuals who are poor, black and brown, underserved, returning citizens, these are the individuals that are constantly being punished. So how do they return to their communities? How do they return to their communities where now they have a chance to not only, as you said earlier, not only to survive, but just to live, right? So, mm-hmm. so, or is it that you can't ever return, right? And then, don't forget the front end of this conversation. It wasn't that I was a criminal, right? Look at what I got locked up for. Like I didn't kill nobody. I was out here trying to survive because you created a situation where I was forced to survive, and then you supplied the drugs. And then not only did you supply the drugs, after you supplied the drugs, you wrote a law to criminalize me, and then you mm-hmm. locked me up for it. Right? So that is why this is important. So doing work with the Illinois Alliance for Reentry and Justice, and what they're doing is they're seeking to build and advance a movement throughout the state of Illinois that's going to be committed to building a robust statewide coordination of reentry advocacy. And that's what they're going to be focused on. And I'm going to be doing everything in my power to be able to make sure that that's getting done. And that's going to be part of the tour that we're going to be having. And that's why we're hitting where all those prisons are at.
Definitely. And then as far as, you know, people, you know, who are locked up, you know, who are locked up now or might be going through their, going through a situation that are coming out, you know, are they, I mean, you know, you just said that, you know, you had your issue that you went through. Is that open for everyone to still, I guess, how do I word this question? I'm getting pretty wordy here. So like,
just say it.
I know, right? Personally, I thought a lot about, you know, about that whole scenario, you know, because for me, I get upset. You know, I'm not going to lie. Like, I get frustrated, you know, especially when I see, like, you know, they are now making millions of dollars off the same thing that they, you know, sent someone away for 15 years, you know.
Right.
like for me,
I wanted to comment on that. I don't know if you had heard when I was on here, but part of HB 1438, right? Part of that bill, right, is the 3R part of it. Because what is supposed to happen? What is supposed to happen? And this is why we have to make sure that the bill is fully implemented. And this is with all of the bills. Because as long as you don't make sure that it's implemented, the bill is there, but the law isn't enforced. But part of that bill is to make sure that those harms were repaired. And through the 3R programs, they're supposed to come back and reinvest in those communities. So communities that was devastated, impacted by the war on drugs, these are the communities that this money is supposed to go to. So a portion of the tax dollars are supposed to go back into those communities to help with the churches, to help with the businesses there, because what happened with the churches, what happened with the schools, what happened with the banks and the businesses was that they were all affected. They were all affected through redlining. They were all affected through all this population being pulled up out of there, right? And then these were all workers, right? People aren't realizing the total devastation that the communities had. And it was always like, well, you know, all of their communities look that way because don't nobody know why all of our communities look like war zones. It was because war was struck on our communities, and it wasn't the war on drugs. The war was on us, and that's serious. Mm-hmm. That's not just a catchphrase, right? The war was on us. We were the ones that was the victims of that, right? And it was all for them to be in positions of power. So we need to get that straight. It was so they could be in positions of power, and they saw fit, right? Even like when they saw fit to use us as their capital. Right, and that's what it all came down to. So we're still reeling from the fact that they're now seriously just admitting, but have not paid for it, but just admitting that, you know what, the CIA did put crack cocaine in our communities, right, and our communities mm-hmm. were targeted, right. Now that is being said and it's being heard, but it's like, shh, don't say it too loud, right? But right. You know, what happens when now the proof is there, but then nobody said that this is what y'all need to do to fix that? Because it's crazy, right? When you can look at the west side and see how the west side of Chicago look, and they talk about the heroin epidemic, right? Mm-hmm. And they talk about the Heron Highway and look at how their communities look, and these are all, they were all bums and they're all just on drugs, right? And this is how they demonize our communities. But then when you look at the white affluent communities, and individuals are now off all of these, are now addicted to opioids, right? You look at a total different approach. It's like, no, they're victims and they need help, right? So we're going to push billions of dollars into these communities, and we're going to hold these pharmaceutical companies responsible for this harm, right? That was what the contrast was. When it was the mm-hmm. opioid addiction, this is how it was dealt with. When it was a heroin and crack addiction, right, this is how that was dealt with. It was take all of them and lock them up, right? They're all criminals, right? Not only is that young man a criminal, his girlfriend is a criminal, his kids are criminals, his grandmom and his mama. The whole community is criminal. So then they're getting a pass when they come into our communities and they're shooting individuals down, right? And individuals aren't saying nothing because it's like, hey, you know, that's what they do over there, right? It's mm-hmm. their fault that they're like that. And that is what the difference in all of this is, and why it's important for us to have these conversations. Because what individuals aren't realizing is this is how they demonize you before they come in to destroy you, right?
Right.
Because, you know, nobody's going to say anything to them. Like, it shouldn't have to take individuals saying, okay, like, how long have individuals been saying, you know what, we have dirty police out here. That police put a pack on me, or that police lied.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, we got to stand up for the blue. And you know what, that's a police, so you know what they said is right. But we forget
right.
that three of the recent videos of fatal police involved shootings, right, or where individuals died by the hands of the police, these individuals were part of the informal economy. Most notable, it was Eric Gardner out of New York, right? He was out here selling cigarettes, and you put him in a chokehold and kill this man? All right, and then that's showing exactly where we're at, right? Even when you see, like I said earlier, when you see individuals committing treason, right? They're committing treason. They're going in and saying they're going to stop the vote to put
hang Mike Pence. Hang Mike Pence. That's what they was chanting. Hang Mike Pence.
Right. So, and then these individuals got to go home. They got to leave there. We saw them individuals holding their hands, walking them back down the stairs, right?
Mm-hmm.
After they came in and did an so this is what we're talking about. And until we deal with this as a people and quit arguing amongst each other and having these, like, inside the house where, you know, I'm better than you and I know what I'm talking about and you just need to listen to me. Like, no, look at what's happening. They don't care about none of us. Right? And this is what they resort to. This is what they do. When they get upset, right, this is what they go to do. But none of them are being held accountable for this. Out of all of those people we saw there, by the last count that I've taken, they have 175 individuals that they arrested so far. Out of all of those people that we saw there, right? So this is, but I know for sure, 100% without a shadow of a doubt, if you are a leader of an organization and you commit a crime, they charge everyone with the RICO Act and it's a conspiracy charge, and everyone that's affiliated with that, they're all being picked up. I don't care if you was 10 years old when that organization started. When you said you was a part of that organization, you're a part of that organization, and you're going to get everything that that first person got, period. Right?
Right.
Y'all all being charged with the same thing. So I don't understand this, right? But this is the America that we're living in. And this is why we need to really open our eyes as a people, love on each other a whole lot more, all right? And as one of the callers has said earlier, right, just because you think you made it or you think you have a little bit more than me, don't look your nose down at me or don't try to help me up out here, because it's nothing for you to be back in this situation, right? Because you're
right.
One heartbeat away from being back in the same place.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's 100% true. I mean, I remember personally, you know, talk about being down and out. I didn't know not only what I was going to eat, but I didn't know where I was going to sleep, you know, the next day. So, I mean, like, you know, we all go through our struggles, and I think our struggles is what make us, you know, the better versions of ourselves. You know, I think, you know, coming out of it and looking back from where you've been and using that as motivation to, you know, to project yourself forward, you know, is something that we all need, you know, to do. Some of the things that, you know, you were just talking about, like, for example, you know, excuse me, how, you know, with the opioid epidemic, how they went after these, you know, pharmaceuticals, and they, you know, they wanted reimbursement. I just think it's amazing. I just think it's amazing when you look at the black community, you know, that anything to help the black community out is just like automatically, no, we shouldn't do that. You know?
Yeah.
They talk horrible about socialism. They talk horrible about socialism until it's NCAA basketball. You know, it's like, you know, like I'd be having these conversations like, well, then these people wouldn't get to play. I said, well, why does that matter? You know, in capitalism, the best place, period. You know, and if they can't even comprehend that at all. They like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on, time out. We don't want to do all that. You know, like, for example, we talk about reparations, you know, with black people, you know, for slavery. It's like, well, how much you think, you know, you guys should get? And I'm like, well, I mean, I think, you know, millions. You want to be completely honest, you know? Like, you want me to, you know, break it down for you? They was like, oh, no, why millions? I'm like, well, if you add up 400 years of non-charged slavery, 400 years, And then you add in gerrymandering. You add in redlining. You add in the black code. You add in Jim Crow. Like, I mean, it never stopped. It evolved. I can't say that it evolved.
That's one of the major things that you just said, is that it never stopped. Because I was just going to let you go, and I was going to see what you're going to finally say. You got to understand that we were kidnapped from our homeland, right? So that right there, right, we did not come over here willingly, right? And so, and then when we got here, we was forced to work. So it started in a kidnapping, all right? So you have to start paying right there from that act. All right, and that's where it started. And everything that you gained from that kidnapping, that's what you owe us. And that's just the bottom line to it. We built the whole country. They would not have been able to survive without us teaching them how to even farm the land. They could not do any of this, right? They did not work any of this land. So we built the country. So the country is really owed to us. And that's my standpoint, right? Individuals say, well, Alonzo, you know that they're never going to give us that, right? So, but what is it that we are owed? But when you look at the state that we're in, I don't say, and a lot of my allies will say this, say, well, at least put us at a level playing field, right? They're never going to do that, because every time we even, it's like this. They didn't even want us to know how to read, right?
Right.
And it was a reason for
right.
that, right? It's a reason for that. They don't want us to be eating that good food, right? It's a reason for that. They don't even want us, because we already were operating in a role where they feared that. Because it was like, hey, how are they surviving out there in that sun? They couldn't do it, okay?
Right.
So with these things being said, all right, they're not going to provide the level playing field, because it would be uneven for them, all right, just right off back. So with that being said, we have to use all of our resources that we have, use them for ourselves, go forward and do everything that we know that we can do, right? I'm a big advocate of working with everything you got to get everything that you want, right? We've been doing so much with so little for so long, we're now almost able to do anything with nothing, and this is real. But the truth is, I think that we're often stumbling over ourselves, stumbling over pride, stumbling over arrogance, just looking at, and it's all going back to dealing with trauma. It's all going back to dealing with trauma. And we have to finally have a safe place for us to be able to address that, and then we'll be able to move forward.
100%. I mean, I think, you know, Meek Mills, he talked a lot about that, you know, especially in his album, and just, you know, through, you know, some of the things that he was going through, if you watch a lot of his interviews and most likely a lot of his interviews, you know, he talked heavily about, you know, the trauma that, you know, watching, you know, a kid get killed. All right. Now imagine, you know, watching that over and over and over again. You know,
imagine watching it over and over, whereas you normalize it. Imagine you walking down the street and you experience over and over the police pulling you over and shaking you down, right? Where it just becomes part of your routine. Imagine when you're driving that you're automatically programmed that when the police pull you over, make sure your hands are out of the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they can't say that you're reaching for a gun, right? Imagine being programmed like this, but then nobody else have to operate like this except us. So
you have to
train individuals that you love to do the same so that they can survive. Because you know what? Your life can be taken just because they made a mistake. Or they would say, and this was something that was like profound to me, and I was waiting to hear this. We often heard individuals, police officers say that I was in fear of my life. That's why I drew my weapon and I shot, right? And I was trained to shoot point blank range or mass range or whatever it is, right? So that's what the police officer said. When they stormed the Capitol, did you not feel that your life was in danger?
Right. Me and my fiance were just talking about this. I'm not going to even lie to you. We were literally just talking. I literally just said this. I believe it was today. It was either today or yesterday.
Your training didn't come in. You have a gun on the side of your hip, and these individuals are throwing things at you. They're rushing you, right? They're physically fighting you, but you don't feel that your life is in danger. And it's
not
because we are treated differently. And it's different rules for us, and this is how divided this country is, and this is what's not being talked about, all right? And this is why we have to not only do the organizing, the teaching, the informing, but saying, hey, something has to change, right? And this is where the real fight starts, because we have to move away from the talking to action, because what you saw there was a stark contrast in everything that we've been told and everything that we was forced to believe, right? Well, you know, he probably did something. That was the things that I was hearing when I went to the faith-based community. Those are the things that I was hearing from our women. You know, you shouldn't be out there like that. You know, honey, just come home and, you know, don't raise your voice and don't say nothing to these people because they just want us to survive as men, right? And they're having to constantly step out there in front of us saying, hey, baby, don't say nothing to them, right? But what we saw was these people run up on at this Capitol, run up on these police officers, tell them, we'll take your gun and shoot you with it. And none of them drew their guns, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was the one time that they did draw a gun, one woman was shot. She was killed out of that 100, out of those hundreds of thousands of individuals that was there, right? Let's look at those numbers. But we had police officers die.
Right.
We had police officers die. So let's move on to the next argument. All this stand behind the blue, right? Was they standing behind the blue then? Was they supporting the blue then?
Right.
So this is us having to get away from this media and what the media is telling us, and then look at the facts. Like, we can't continue to keep on playing into that or swallowing that or accepting just what they're telling us. But believe me, this has went inside our programming, because the bottom line, everybody just want to go home, man. When us as a people, we really do just want peace. We just want to be able to live. And the truth is, we're tired of, I see a lot that we're tired of fighting. We have to fight everywhere, all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is what we're really fighting up against. And man, especially as an organizer, it at times can have a drain on you, right? So that's why I'm excited when I hear about other individuals wanting to get involved. Individuals saying, you know, I'm going through that same thing. How can we do what you all are doing? How can we all join you? It means so much, because I'm telling you, one person cannot do this by himself, right?
Right.
And it is going to take all of us working together to get it done.
And I think we got a caller that, you know, wanted to chime in that they wanted to talk about. 6598.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Did you have a? Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I believe that the question that I have is regarding the NFL concussion lawsuit, because I know everything that you're talking about, I feel like it's tying into this also, because I know it's the issue between black and white players in the NFL, where black players filed for medical compensation claims and they were denied, but their white co-players, where they all played next to each other, and are now coming out in lawsuits regarding how they have been treated, and the NFL will not release the demographics for how many people. Yeah, they will not release the demographics for how many people black or white, who have filed lawsuits. How do you see, you know, this as being a part of, you know, our black people, even though they may be up high in the NFL, still being treated the same way that these people are being treated on the streets? Because it's just like nothing has changed. I don't care how high you get. I don't care how much money you're making. And I don't care who you're working for. It's like, but still, yeah, just because you're black, you are not being treated equally as far as, you know, your skin color is concerned. How can we take that and put that part into legislation? Because it's just like us black people who are may have worked very hard all our lives, but still yet we're not getting the medical necessities that we are, you know, that we are paying for.
So for me to answer that question, I have to first say that, first, thank you for bringing that point up, and then it's in direct relation to everything that we have been saying. I don't know how much time we have, so I want to make sure that I do answer this. Okay, I want to make sure that I do answer this in all clarity. You're absolutely right when you say, even though it may seem as we've went far, we've went nowhere. It's the same thing with the red line, and the same thing with insurance, the same thing with having to pay for your furniture for the rest of your life, right? They've always, the same thing when they went and they got insurance on the slaves, right? Whereas we was just treated as chattel. So the only way that I see it, the only model that I have, and a lot of my counterparts are will probably disagree with me and probably will have some good arguments to it, but the models that I have seen all have been models of us stepping away from them and working amongst ourselves where we did not have to deal with them because they could not put a value on us then. We had the value for ourselves, right? And we saw this when you, again, when you saw Bronzeville out of Chicago, when you saw Black Wall Street, right, where we were able to have our own value, where, you know what, I'm not going to allow you to place a value on me, but as long as, and it's just, it's capitalism, as long as I work for you, you can place a value on me. You can determine whether or not I get $15 an hour, whether I get $50,000 a year, all right, because you're paying me for my labor. But when I get to pay myself, right, because I'm an entrepreneur, because I'm a business owner, right, when I write my own check, everything changes. And that's why we feel like there's such an attack on an informal community, because that's the way we've been writing our own checks. And so now I'm looking at that we have to move from criminality to survivability, and this comes with being able to create the laws that removes the criminal aspect from us being, from us surviving, but then also with informing individuals, right, on what all of this really means. So I would definitely love to come back and be able to talk more about this, because we can't do it all in one episode, but there's a lot of information that I believe needs to be shared. You all can definitely go to www.eatchicago.org. You can just pull all our information from there. We're going to be having a lot of events this throughout the month of Black History Month, which is for us the kickoff to the Black History Year. We don't believe that it's 1 month that we have to celebrate our history, our love, our accomplishments. So this is our kickoff for what it should look like for the rest of the year. And I hope that you all will choose to be involved and continue to do this work with us.
Awesome. Yeah, go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, I was just saying, that is great. And, of course, I'm definitely going to have you back on. And
okay,
I will be talking to you.
Okay.
Hey, keep up the great work. Right. Thanks for having coming out here, you know, spreading the gospel. You know, I think, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's good to hear, especially from real world people who got their feet on the ground and is actually out there in the movement, you know, pushing things. So, hey, stay on the grind. You know, we support you. You're always welcome to come back and talk. And, you know, like I said, thank you once again.
All right. Thank
and
you
I'll
all.
Be contacting you about some of the things you're doing where we can work together.
Okay, no problem. Definitely looking at being able to do collaboration.